They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to the Crossover NBA Podcast. Thank you for joining us this week. Got a great episode lined up for you. And guess who is in studio once again? This time, we're actually sitting across from each other. We were in fake studio together the last couple of times.
I thought you didn't disclose that information.
I usually don't, but sometimes like the audio can be so little off where people are like, you can't be in the same room, right? It sounded like we were in the same room.
Did it, though?
I mean, better than like a phone call.
What I find funny is that when you text me about coming on the pod and then you say, oh, I'm going to be in New York, we'll be in studio together, you think that that is a positive. Like, oh, it should be more enticing to come on the podcast because I'll be there, we'll be in the studio together. Quite the contrary.
You know, well, you
like,
couldn't have, you couldn't
can I
have
cancel
had,
now?
You
I already
have
said
had
I'm
the
available.
Conversation you had before the podcast without me being in studio, which we're not going to.
I would like to remove that from my mind right now.
If you want to hear more about that conversation, check out the boxing podcast a little bit later in the week. It's
can I join?
You can. You're welcome to be a friend of the boxing pod as well. Dual podcast. You want to do some soccer too? Maybe.
I used to play soccer growing up.
I believe that. You were quite the basketball player, too. I saw on the broadcast on Sunday the side-by-side picture of you and
Dominique Wilkins.
Yes.
He's the reason I wore 21.
Yes.
All right, we should get to real stuff because no one cares about this.
You and Dominique, you know, same level.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, let's talk about Sunday's game. Kyrie Irving makes his return. I got to tell you,
surprise. Oh, this is why you were watching the broadcast.
Yes, I wasn't watching for like John Collins and see what he was doing with
the
Hawks.
I didn't know if you were just interested in watching Nets on Yes.
Nets on Yes, number one broadcast team in the NBA, except when Ruko's on. You know, then it takes a slight dip, but you know. Ruko's my boxing broadcast partner as well. So.
I know, and Grady is your arch nemesis.
Grady
is
just the worst, but we'll leave that alone.
He's amazing.
Kyrie Irving makes his return to the lineup. I was a little surprised he came back, to be honest with you.
At what point?
I feel like when the calendar turned to January, it's like, all right, we're now into 2020. You know, the team is not a championship contender. This is clearly a significant problem. We've gone well past the idea that Kyrie was ducking playing in Boston. That happened a month and a half ago.
Do you now realize that it's not accurate?
I never said he was ducking. Players don't duck. Especially guys like Kyrie. Kyrie wants to go back to Boston and score 50. Like, that's what he wants to do. Always what he wanted to do. But I was surprised. Like, given the shoulder injury, it didn't sound like he was getting much better. But then, all of a sudden, a few days ago, he's back at practice doing 5-on-5, and now he's giving it a go. What was your reaction to Kyrie making his return on Sunday?
Well, I think we learned a lot more information when he spoke to the media a few days into the new year, and him basically telling us that he was struggling with this because it wasn't getting better, and he was going to see different specialists. He was trying to figure out what was going on, and then finally got a cortisone shot on December 24th, and that's where the trajectory of things, his progress, everything, how he was going about his rehab started to improve. And so I think just as soon as hearing he spoke, he said he kind of said, I'm going to give it a week and see how it feels. He, of course, throughout all of this was trying to avoid having surgery. And by all accounts, what we were hearing once, because he had been doing non-contact drills and he'd been on the court, he'd been doing a lot of things, but just didn't feel doctors include everyone that he was cleared for contact. So got the cortisone shot, was feeling better. And in that week, the Nets, due to their schedule, had a couple good practices. And he was tremendous. And back to, you know, the Kyrie, as we saw the other night. I will say this, I was not surprised that he played. You never know. I think with injuries, I think all speculation, people from the outside not knowing what's going on, I think can be really irresponsible. So the fact that he did play, what I was surprised by and just thought was tremendous and fun to watch, and I know Atlanta is not a world beater, and of course Trae Young was not playing, just how highly efficient he was, how fluid he seemed, how, and you look at his numbers, he was, what, 10 of 11 from the field, played just under 20 minutes. So the points, the assists, all just, he looked so comfortable and like he had been playing, you know, over the course of the fact that he missed the last 2 months. And so that to me was like, wow.
Yeah, he looked like Kyrie Irving. He looked like Kyrie Irving, which is very surprising given how much time that he's missed.
Because I would say that about any player. Anytime you're not on the court playing, you would expect there to be a transition period.
Yeah. Look, I think one of the things that might help ease his transition back into playing for the team is the fact that they've been bad, you know, prior to him coming back. I mean, what was it? How many losses in a row before the Miami game?
Seven losses in a row.
And this was like on top of, you know, back in, what was it, November, they started to win a little bit, and all those stories came out about, like, here are the Nets' numbers without Kyrie Irving, here are their numbers with Kyrie Irving. People would say, well, are they better without Kyrie? Which is always nonsense. I mean, the guys...
It's all nonsense, but I also, I've spoken about this a decent amount. I think none of that ever took into account, so he played 11 games early on. None of that took into account how many moving parts and new parts there were on the roster in it of itself. So for any team, any new roster compilation, you're going to have a process where it takes time for guys to get used to each other. So I think throughout the course of that, Caris LeVert, of course, getting hurt, throughout the course of when they were playing, well, a lot of it to me was just guys get like a Garrett Temple getting more comfortable, Torian Prince getting more comfortable. Spencer Dinwiddie was not good at the beginning of the season, and then he started playing at an all-star level. And obviously some of this created opportunity due to playing time. However, I think there was so much focus and emphasis on what they were with and without Kyrie that it didn't take into account at all. Just by nature, a new team with new pieces sometimes takes time.
But that's always going to be the case with Kyrie. After what happened in Boston, you know, there's always going to be a contrast between what he did, you know, what the team does with him on the floor and with him without on the floor. And
look, I would say for any, not just any star.
Him more so, though, because like there's the as Boston surges.
Maybe
like,
the Boston
faithful.
No, but I
mean, that's kind of established, but it's kind of established sort of like, I think everybody's kind of looking at what the Celtics are and the fact that like Kemba's like sort of the anti-Kyrie in Boston terms of personality and saying like, you know, Kyrie's got a lot to prove in a season like this. And nobody questions his talent, but it's the chemistry stuff. And one thing I'm looking for in the next month, if he continues to play, the passing, right? Like before he went out of the lineup, the Nets, I think, were 27th in the NBA in passing. And then he goes out and the passing improves. Like, does the ball stick too much when Kyrie's out there on the floor? Because he can do some unreal things with the ball, but that's not what this team needs. You got to get everybody involved. You got to keep Spencer Dinwiddie on this train that he's on. You got to get Caris LeVert back into everything. You got to make sure guys like Jared Allen and Joe Harris get their touches. Like, that's a big thing to watch, I think, for Kyrie over the next month.
I do think that's a big thing to watch. I think that's a big thing to watch for any team in any offense. However, in looking at that, and I think that was another positive to draw from the game against Atlanta and just the first game, but just how well the ball moved, how everyone was getting touches, everyone was involved. There was a ton of balance in terms of spreading that out. I do think, though, there's a certain balance of, we even looked at some numbers of usage rates and comparisons of what Spencer Dinwiddie was doing and how much the ball was in his hands, how many ISOs the Nets have been utilizing, whether it was Spencer, whether it was Torian Prince, you name it, even when Kyrie was not playing. So again, I think it goes to, there's different ways, there's different kind of viewpoints of taking a look at the ball sticking or isolation plays or when guys are going one-on-one versus is this a part of the fluidity of the offense. And I think that'll be a major thing. But that's a part of Kenny Atkinson, the coaching staff's job. How do we make sure everyone is involved?
Do you think that there's pressure on Kyrie to, I mean, look, not win at a Milwaukee or even a Boston type of level, but to prove that you can be the man on a team that wins with this group? Like, there's three plus months left in the regular season. What kind of pressure do you think is on him? What should the expectations be for this Nets team with Kyrie in the lineup?
I think there's a difference between pressure. I think there's differentiating factors between pressure, between expectations, and between goals in what this team is trying to do. And I think, obviously, with Kyrie back, I do think it's such a major factor, Caris LeVert being back as well. I think the fact that those two, their time coincided together being out, is something to take note of, the fact that LeVert wasn't playing as well. I think this team believes, and I'm not sure, you know, looking at the standings, looking at the schedule, how much time is left, can you end up catching there in what the, I should have this up, the eighth spot now, right behind Orlando.
Oh, you
Orlando.
Can guess the eighth spot. The eighth spot stinks. Like, the seventh.
They're in the seventh. So yeah, they're seventh, in seventh. Eighth, like, just moved ahead. But I think, theoretically, you're about five games out of the sixth spot. I think you look at, you know, five games out of the sixth spot, you're actually, so you're eight games behind, you know, number three Miami. So looking at Toronto, theoretically.
Goes the other way, too. I mean, who's like 10 or 11 in that spot? I mean, how far are they behind
Chicago
Brooklyn?
Chicago is 10. Charlotte is 9. So you got.
How is Charlotte 9?
Charlotte is 9, and they are.
I put Terry Rozier on the All-Star team.
Charlotte is 9, and they're 5 games behind 7th place
Here's
Brooklyn.
Here's a hot take for you.
They're 4. They're 4.5 games behind Orlando.
So some wiggle room there. I mean,
I think obviously you think about making the playoffs, but mm-hmm. I think you theoretically make a put. You still in your heads. I think you. I don't know what pressure you would look at or what expectations should be, but that four spot. Is that four spot available? Is that four spot open? Do you feel like you? But that's my point. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not sure internally where the goals would be set at this point. I think it's less about standings, less about where you land in the East, and more about are we improving as a team? Are we collectively getting all of your questions that are still questions of what does our offense look like? How is our ball movement? How are we making sure that we're balancing out? We have now this depth of player. We looked at Kenny Atkinson, and who was looking for bodies before, and now he's able to comfortably go 10 deep in his rotation. How do we make sure everyone is playing at their best? I think it's those type of things, which may not be tangible to look at or quantifiable to look at numbers or look at what, but are we seeing a visible improvement in just how the way that we're playing? And in the area of improvement, you know, for the Nets and when they were playing, what had been defensively, they created more of a defensive identity, figure out how they want to play. I think that continuing to stay where it's at and improve. So I think all of those things, I'm not sure that gives you any type of an answer of what exactly are the expectations, but I think it's all of that. I think in another month and a half, or after the All-Star break, you'll get a good feel of, okay, they're laying a solid foundation. This is exactly the type of team. They're playing how they want to play. Kyrie Irving is leading the way, but you've got these complementary players in Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, Joe Harris playing at the level he would. There's all these players that fit their roles, and are they executing at the highest level possible? And I think that's a lot of the questions that need to be answered.
I think it's twofold for the rest of the season. One is, you know, play well, reasonably well, but the bigger part of it is don't hate each other. Like, don't end the season. Like, it goes back to what I thought in September. Like, just don't hate each other. Believe at the end of the season that this group with Kevin Durant added to the mix can be good. Don't end the season with like, oh shit, we got to trade.
I feel that way.
Spencer Dinwiddie. Like,
I feel that way every time we start a podcast. This is don't hate each other
at the end.
Don't hate each other.
By the way, have you bought Spencer Dinwiddie stock or bond yet? Have you bought into?
I need to. No, I would.
I would even.
I have his bobbleheads. I'm not real.
Is that any trade right now? Can we do that?
You know what I think? In all sincerity, the Spencer Dinwiddie, which I'm fascinated by. I have a lot of friends in the financial world that have been reading these articles and trying to fill me in on it, and it's not sticking yet. I think you need to be of a certain elk of a trader in order to. I think he's trying to open it up to the masses eventually, but I think at this point you need to have a certain. There's letters and numbers that are involved in this. I have his Iron Man bobblehead though.
That's what it doesn't
release until January 18th, first Milwaukee. So
collector's item early. I have read every single story about the Dinwiddie bond. I couldn't, gun to my head, I couldn't answer a single question on it. I don't know what it is. I don't know how it works.
It's a digital token.
That doesn't mean anything to me. Like, kind of thing you put in Subway or like you put into...
Digital token.
Skee-ball?
I don't know. I've got some buzzwords.
I don't understand any of it.
It is fascinating. What I appreciate most, and I'm a huge fan of Spencer Dinwiddie. I'm still helping lead the All-Star campaign. When he talks about, similar to with a lot of players, Brooke Lopez, when you talk to him about comics... about Star Wars, when players get so passionate about something that they're behind, this isn't just a novelty for him. This isn't just a unique way to create it. He is passionate about doing this, about the work he's put in, the effort him and his team have put in to create this. So I think it's really cool, really special what he's doing. And I think it's fun when you talk to players when they're outside of basketball, some of their other interests, when they're so passionate about what it is they're doing.
Had to bring Brooke Lopez into that conversation.
I've got to bring Brooke Lopez into everything.
All right, let's talk about the Lakers for a minute, and specifically Kyle Kuzma. Before the season, we talked about the Lakers being kind of a two-star team with the potential for a third. Kuzma was that kind of rising guy that the Lakers weren't going to part with. They were going to play him alongside LeBron and AD, and he would be that third scorer who would blossom maybe in a system where he gets open shots. Hasn't worked out that way. He was injured throughout the preseason, fallout from an injury with USA Basketball. And since he's been back, he has struggled to find some chemistry. Now, he did have a really good game. Was it the other night when he had
Oklahoma City.
26 points?
Yeah. Dallas and Oklahoma City. He's had two good games.
With injuries, to Davis and to LeBron. The question is, can Kuzma thrive when those two are on the floor? And I think the jury's still out. I mean, we're hearing already trade rumors surrounding him. Sacramento, Bojan Bogdanovic potentially being talked about there. Other teams that I know have been talking to Lakers about Kuzma. From what you've seen the Lakers, are you surprised that it hasn't worked out for Kuzma there? Why hasn't it worked out for Kuzma out there?
I don't know if surprised is the right word. I think I was anxiously awaiting kind of how things were going to pan out. Kyle Kuzma is a really nice player. And I think that with any young player, even though the thing, you know, you forget about the fact he was 4 years. So he's 24 years old. It's not like he's one of these guys you look at that's still 21, 22. I think you see that that's what a young player can bring you. They bring you inconsistency. So you see these flashes of brilliance, the playmaking, the creating his own shot, the scoring ability, the size that he brings to the table. And also you see some instances of it's like, okay, is this guy going to become the player that we need him to be? I think it's, to me more than anything, and I don't know what I anticipated going in, it's been a tough fit. Like, you would think he would fit so well next to LeBron and Anthony Davis. I don't know if it's because they've been playing, as they talked about, a lot of heavy minutes with guys at center. I mean, the fact that they've been playing, you know, Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee and those guys getting that type of time at that center position, I don't know if that has changed the dynamic of where he's playing, how he fits. He's not really a catch-and-shoot guy. Like, he hasn't, you think about the players you want to surround Anthony Davis and LeBron James with, and it's not a high-volume, create-your-own-shot type of player. So I'm not really sure. And I don't know with the Lakers, it's another fascinating thing of normally you would look at a player like Kuzma and say he's still young. He's only in his third year. He's shown, you know, signs of some really solid things. Do we hold on to him? We got a couple. Like, where are the Lakers at in terms of their this season, like, must win a championship now mode given the timeline of LeBron? Or do you think more about, okay, the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years down the line? So I'm not sure too, just the fact that if you are thinking about, obviously, which they are, the playoffs, a title contention, like the lack of playoff experience, how does that factor in? Not knowing what you're going to get out of that position or out of that player when it comes to an opportunity to play in the postseason. So it's, I don't know. I don't know what they do. I don't know if there's a exact right thing. I'm not sure when you look at what trade options or possibilities might be available to them, what you do. They don't have a ton of picks. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, so it's not like.
I think one thing it's important to note off the top is that the third star on any LeBron team has struggled in that first year. I mean, Chris Bosh struggled
Good
in that
point.
First year in
Good
Miami.
Good point.
Kevin Love struggled in that first year in Miami. Now, I'm not putting Kuzma in that same class. Those are two all-star players, but he is the de facto third banana with that group. And history shows that guy struggles to find his role, especially when you look at the first couple of years of Kuzma's career. He's been on bad teams and has been given a lot of freedom to go out there and to score. With this Laker team, he's being asked to structurally kind of stand in one spot, be an open three-point jump shooter. He hasn't done that at the highest of levels. Just play off LeBron and Anthony Davis, and he hasn't figured that out. I think a big problem was missing the preseason, not being able to get some chemistry going with those guys early. But if you're going to keep Kyle Kuzma around, when LeBron and Davis are on the floor, you just got to force feed him minutes. Like, even if they result in net negatives, you've got to get this guy comfortable with playing alongside these two, or else you're not going to succeed in the playoffs.
Not to cut you off, because when he was well, I want you to keep going. But he was right around. He was averaging what, like 22 minutes a game or so. So now, when he's had a higher volume, I think he only, I saw the stats somewhere, played, he had like two games where he played 30 minutes. So to your point, he's not playing a high dose of minutes.
No, and some of that too is clearly injury. I mean, you have a foot injury, you
right.
ease a guy back in the lineup. But he averaged 31, 33 minutes his first two seasons. He's down to 24 minutes per game with the Lakers this season. The three-point shooting has come around a little bit over the last month or so, but he's still right around 35%. You'd like to see that up a little bit higher at this point. But I think he's the key to everything. I think if you are the Lakers, you can kind of count on Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. You can kind of count on your two-headed center monster with JaVale McGee and Dwight Howard. But Kuzma's the one guy that has shown the potential to get you buckets. So if AD is struggling or a good defense bottles him up, if LeBron is struggling with his shot, you need Kuzma to make shots on the outside. That's why I think it just shove him out there on the floor with AD and with LeBron, get him a lot of minutes together in the second half of the season, and just hope that chemistry can develop on the fly, because I don't think the Lakers beat the Clippers, maybe not the top teams in the West, like the Nuggets right there, the Rockets even. I don't know if you can beat them with just those two guys in AD and LeBron and not enough around him scoring. I think Kuzma's got to develop that third score for that team to win a championship.
Do you think it's more important, then would you put more priority on, rather than just, let's see if we can find a 3-and-D guy, has your perspective at all changed? And I'm not sure if mine has. I think it has a little bit. But given how good their defense has been, less reliant on trying to find a player that can go, like, are you thinking about playing against the Clippers? Who's going to go out and guard Kawhi? And Paul
I'm not
George,
even thinking about
gonna,
the defensive side. I'm more worried at this point about the offensive side.
Right.
Making shots.
And do you think that Kuzma is solid enough that he's going to do the things you need to do offensively?
I don't know.
To sustain?
I mean, I really don't know the answer to that. I do think that he's just way too young and on way too good a contract
yep.
to just give up
yeah.
on. So if you're the Lakers and you can get a Bogdanovic back in a deal, maybe you got to pay that guy in the offseason. But I wouldn't give him away just for kind of a 3-and-D type of guy that might be
a Jay Crowder or
yeah,
Robert Covington or
no. I mean, Covington's kind of interesting, but no. There's just too much potential there. And you are, if you're
Was the Bogdanovic thing not really real? That's
not really. I don't think the as
and that
and I,
that
I'm as critical of the Sacramento Kings as anyone, and I think that
Bogdanovic
there needs
is
to be a
good.
Well,
like
there
he's
needs, on a separate note, there needs to be a 30-for-30 done on how in the name of hell Sacramento passed on Luka Doncic. Like, how did you do it? You've got Vlade Divac, one of the great international players of all time, running your organization. His number two is Peja Stojakovic, a terrific basketball player in his time. And you passed on Luka. How? I'm not criticizing Marvin Bagley. Good player, but not Luka. Like, even Phoenix, like, all right, Ayton, fine, whatever. I can see the potential there. How do you look at what Luka's doing in the EuroLeague and pass on that guy?
You could watch the EuroLeague.
I want them to explain. I want them to sit down at a press conference and go step by step on how you came to this decision.
Maybe
what
you should
did
do,
you not see?
Maybe you should do a nice little piece on it for SI.
I'm so tired of, like, writing about Sacramento. Like, I've just, and every time, and people in Sacramento, like on Twitter, they hate me because every time I write about them, it's something critical, but that they just don't give you anything. Like, you want to be able to write something really positive if it's there, but they keep making mistakes, just mistake after mistake. And Luka Doncic is going to be a multiple-time MVP.
He might be my favorite player.
Yes.
Go down as my favorite. He's currently my favorite player to watch.
Yes, and
but
he
may
doing
be
it.
My favorite player ever.
He was doing it in Europe. He was overseas winning the EuroLeague MVP. And all you heard before the draft, the negatives, it was like, oh, well, his body's not that good. Yeah, you have like 17 strength coaches on his staff. You think you can't figure that out?
And he was like 17 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
Or 18, like, or whatever he was at that time. Like, he's a kid. Look, he's got baby fat.
Remember what Giannis was when he came into the league? He was a string bean. The guy's a tank now, and he's 24, 25. Like, come on. Not athletic enough to compete. Give me a break. That just every time I happen to flip past Sacramento on League Pass, it drives me nuts because that's a team that needs a jolt of energy, like something to revive that franchise. And they passed on the one guy that could do it. I'm not even going to beat up on Atlanta for making that trade. It's not going to work out for them because Luka's going to be better. As I said, Ayton, fine. It's not going to work out for them either, but I understood at the time.
But Sacramento is the one that's really lighting
my
fire.
It drives me crazy. They need a player like that. How did we get on this? Oh,
I don't know.
Let me just this is kind of a roundabout way of me saying on Kuzma, unless I am blown away with an offer for him, I wouldn't deal him. Because even if he winds up costing you this year, which he might, I mean, if he misses like open three or something like that, he's so young. And if you can grow, you're looking at the Davis LeBron, it's like, what, like at least a 3 year?
Yeah,
probably
absolutely.
Because LeBron was like 40. I think you've got to hope that this guy has kind of that Bosch love syndrome in year one. And then year two kind of figures it out. They get a full off season kind of together and all that stuff happens.
And personally, personality wise, he seems comfortable. I do think it's a great point you bring up about his injury. The fact that he missed all of training camp, that affected him early on. He was also starting to play a little better. And then did he have another injury?
Yeah. I forget what the other injury was, but
it was small.
He's been
but
out
just
of the lineup,
yeah, and that affects the guy.
Yeah, no question. I think look, in Frank Vogel, who's a smart coach, he can do some things to kind of get maybe run more plays for him. Like right now, there a lot of stuff is played off of LeBron and AD as it should be. I mean, those guys are great, but maybe run some more play. I don't know, but I'd hold on to him unless I'm blown away with the big offer. Let's keep the topic on trades because we are kind of like a month away from the trade deadline and. I hear a lot of chatter around the league right now about smaller level trades, teams trying to get that sixth, seventh, eighth man to maybe put them over the top. You look at the Eastern Conference right now, and we talked about the bottom of it, but the top's pretty competitive too with a lot of teams that the margin between them is very small. If you look at the teams in the East that maybe are most in need of making a trade, who jumps to mind for you right away?
Well, the team that jumps to mind, I know that you're going to get to. The Boston Celtics,
yes.
Because they're always at the top of your mind. And they're very much a team that's in need of one big trade.
Yes.
Big man. However, so I'm looking through. I think there's a lot of intriguing teams in the East. Just got off of seeing the Miami Heat live. I'm not sure what they could do given their salary cap situation and
in good shape. Like they're because they have a lot of contracts.
I really like them. I think they're a solid team. I think they could be one player away. And
they
I'm not
are
sure.
A strong Kevin Love contender.
Yeah,
a strong Kevin Love contender.
And to me, it's what does Pat Riley want to do? Like where? Because how they've been playing. I mean, I certainly didn't anticipate them to be. Are they two or three now? But. Right behind Milwaukee, battling there with Boston for that second seed. But you could tell, and just the way they play, how comfortable they are with one another, the chemistry they have. You mentioned Kevin Love. I also think the thing with Miami, and then I'm going to get to the other team that I was thinking about. Just the experience, like you have a lot of young guys that when you do head into the postseason are not going to. Bam's been around now for a couple of years. Of course, you have Jimmy Butler, but like. Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, who else? Kendrick Nunn. Like, you have players that have not had that playoff-type experience. So I think the opportunity to not only have one more player to make that jump, but also a player that comes with a whole load of postseason experience certainly would make them very intriguing. I'm just fascinated by the Philadelphia 76ers.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to see, just as a fan of basketball, what unfolds with them, given the fact that they have the highest of high upside, and they also could end up having a really low burnout of a season if they don't all come together.
And they're the only team in the league that can hold you to 85 points in the playoffs.
Like, yeah.
They're that good defensively.
Yeah. And just monsters, mm-hmm. monsters, and the type of size they have, the type of talent they have. But clearly just the fit is such a huge question mark. I know the Joel Embiid injury is something to kind of see how that plays out, how they, you know, fare.
I can't unsee that injury. I can't unsee the finger thing.
Being crooked?
I can't. I saw like a grainy video of it, and it's still like... He's going to have like Lionel Hollins' finger. Like,
I was just about to say, I feel like there's people like Lionel Hollins has like two or three of those fingers that are like that.
How does he still
always
have that? Why does he still have this? That's something, can that be corrected in like surgery and stuff?
I don't want to speculate, okay, but knowing Lionel Hollins, he probably, like, it's kind of a badge of honor. I think
enough.
He probably thinks it's, yeah. Anyway.
War wound. I got you.
But no, like they could use another playmaker. They could use someone like a catch and shoot guy.
But who do they give up to get him though?
I don't know.
Like, they'll move Zaire Smith. Like, that's the one guy. They're not going to move Tybull because they like him a lot.
I like him a lot. Tybull is speaking of the defensive side.
Absolutely. But then you get into like the top tier guys, and like, is there a market for Al Horford with that contract? Probably not. You're not going to move Simmons and Embiid, at least not this season. I guess you could move Josh Richardson in a deal, but what is that going to get you back in return? Like, I agree with you.
And
playmaker,
those are all
shooter. Like, absolutely, yeah. They need that guy. I just don't know who they give up to go and get
it. I agree.
Yeah,
I'm only at A and B. I'm not at C and D. but they're the ones that, like, you think about the teams in the East and who could use a jolt of someone, who can use a change, who needs to fill some certain pieces to make them fit, and they're the one team that it's like, gosh, you could argue that they'd be a title contender. I'll believe you. You could argue to me that they'll be a first or, you know, second round out, and I could roll with any of that. I don't think
they can be a title contender if Ben Simmons won't shoot. And not even like can't shoot. If he won't shoot, it's a problem. Like, they're, and we talked about this a little bit last week, but they are all but begging Ben Simmons to shoot threes out there. Like, begging.
I'm going to hold my opinion. I'll get into him, but until I know we're going to talk about Markelle Fultz,
yeah,
and the reasons why. He, to me, is really exciting. I don't get that. Like, just in even going into the season, it's like just mandate to yourself to take 2 3-point shots a game. Mandate to yourself to take whatever it may be, but a certain number, you just put them up. You can shoot over nearly anyone. Most defenders that are going to be on you, you can get a shot off. So, and when I watch him in warmups, you watch him other times, it's not. I've said this before. It's not some janky shot that you're thinking.
You don't
oh
think,
gosh.
I mean,
like, see, I don't think it looks.
He's still kind of off one foot, and it still has a little bit of side spin on it sometimes.
It's not like, perfect. It's not, you know,
no, like,
you're not
like
drawing this up
a
clinic. Yeah, I think he's got a good follow through. I don't know. I mean, the one-footed thing, I think you see different guys shooting different with their lower body. To me, it's much more. I've had arguments with people about this because some people think that it looks entirely inconsistent and it's not a good.
But there are still some people that think he shoots with the wrong hand.
Like, well,
that still is out there.
Yeah.
Because every time you see him shoot right-handed runners, like, they're going in, they're clean.
Yeah, there's a lot to it, but I wholeheartedly stand behind you. I just would like to see him take shots in the game.
Shoot it.
Just do it. Just keep doing it until...
You start to wonder if it's a mental thing, because he clearly works on it in practice. Ben Simmons is a hardworking guy. Like, he's... Every other part of his game is incredibly strong.
To your questions to the Sacramento Kings,
hey.
I would say I would love to get his take on after... Does he ever go back and look at film and be like, gosh, in this possession... That's always my question. Does he ever go back, look at film, and be like, gosh, in that possession... I was coming off the screen, or I caught that and I thought about shooting, but I'm hesitating too much, or I thought about it here and then the defender came up on me. So I'm curious his actual mind. I would love to be in his mind during the game, or if he just does not know. I don't want to. I don't feel comfortable with my shot. It's not consistent. I don't feel like it's the best shot for my team, so I'm not going to take. I don't know, and I'm curious what those conversations are like, but when he goes back and if he sees instances and opportunities of just not, because of the way he plays, does he not feel open? Is it one of those circumstances where he just never feels open? And then you go back and watch and you're like, man, I had this guy was 2 feet away from me. I could have taken this. I mean, he's clearly open throughout the course of games. What's going on through his mind during those instances? Yeah. I would be curious to learn.
I mean, it started a little passive aggressive in Philly where they're, you know, I saw a quote from Joel Embiid where he's like, you know, we got to get guys shooting or playing outside of their comfort zone. That was clearly directed at Ben Simmons. You know, I was there on Christmas when Elton Brand said, you know, we need Ben to shoot now or else he's not going to shoot in the playoffs. Like, you've got now 3 months to get him comfortable taking those shots, because let's say you get to the second round, you're going to go up against teams that are really good defensively and have really smart defensive coaches, whether it's, you know, Mike Budenholzer in Milwaukee, Eric Spoelstra in Miami, Brad Stevens in Boston, that are going to having the opportunity to dig into one team, find a way to exploit the weakness that is Ben Simmons on the outside. So as great as he is as a defender, as a playmaker in the open floor, and he is great at those aspects, rebounder, he's excellent. He has got to be a threat from out there, because even if a guy moves, and you know this, just a couple of feet in, it changes the complexion of the game, because they can now stuff the paint and make things more problematic for guys like Embiid and Richardson and all the guys that go to the basket.
Think about the way the game has changed. I mean, even in the playoffs, it's tough to have a five out there that doesn't shoot a three. Like, it's, you rarely have a power forward that isn't even, and I'm not saying they have to be knockdown three-point shooters. That's obviously an asset for a team, but throughout the course of the playoffs and how defense can manipulate what they do and how they attack you, it sometimes can be challenging even when you have a big out that's not able to, in some ways, at least be a threat to stretch the floor. So I'm such a huge fan of Ben Simmons. I'm such a huge fan of his game. I do see the thought process of so many people. Why do we focus on this one area and not highlight all the things that he is elite at? I just think he could be such a mind-blowingly amazing player. And you would just love to see him, just to your point, just take those shots. Just get new, because, you know, maybe this season you'll shoot 10% from three, you'll shoot 20%, but next year, the following year, like, it's all about the long term and the big picture and trajectory of his career. So you'd like to see him start doing that now, because he could be a beast.
Well, I think if they could beat, like, in the first round, you know, if they finish on that, you know, sort of 5-4-5 range, they could beat in the first round. You have to have a serious conversation in that front office about it being over. Like, you know, that this, even before we're having conversations like this, it's been ongoing. Should Embiid and Simmons, are they a good match playing together? I think that if it ends early for this team, given how much money they spent on this team in the offseason.
Right. Well, and that's another thing about, in terms of looking for a trade or trade. Like, they mortgaged a lot of what they did last year. Like, think about bringing, when they brought Tobias Harrison, or, you know, with the Jimmy Butler trade initially. Like, they made a lot of big moves even last season going all in to try and make it work. And so that also puts them in, you know, the circumstances they're at right now.
I wonder if they'll regret not paying Jimmy Butler. You know, I've never really got a clear answer about why it didn't work out. The one thing that keeps coming up is that, you know, giving Jimmy Butler a max level contract was not something that they wanted to do. But watching Butler play in Miami and how he completely fits in with what they
it's so awesome. Honestly, it is awesome.
Like, the highly competitive Miami Heat and the highly competitive Jimmy Butler were the perfect match. Like, perfect.
Which I think is interesting now, looking back in all the people that initially were kind of ragging on Jimmy Butler, saying, oh, you say all you want to do is win, but you're leaving a great situation in Philadelphia. And now he's down in Miami winning.
Having and doing well down there. Quickly on my team, I am going to say Boston, just because I continue to beat the
drum. Yeah, please.
The Celtics their recent struggles notwithstanding, the biggest problem continues to be the lack of a big man. And I say this with all respect for Daniel Tice and what he's done defensively for that team, with all respect to Enes Kanter, who's been much better defensively than I thought they were going to be. Like, they lose Baines and Horford, and they are a top five defensive team. That is remarkable that they've been able to pull that off. But if you get to the playoffs, you got to go up against the Lopezes and Giannis in Brooklyn, or in Milwaukee. Maybe you have to cross paths with Philadelphia, and Joel Embiid kills you every single time he plays against you. This is a problem. Now, they have a similar problem to Philadelphia in that they don't have a lot to trade. Like, unless they want to dig in and move Gordon Hayward, They don't have a major contract. Unless they want to move Marcus Smart, they don't have a mid-level type of contract. So really you're looking at the kind of Tice Cantor types who can get you like to like $9 million in total salary and picks. Now, the picks are valuable. They'd still move. I think they'd move off that Memphis pick in a heartbeat now, so the Grizzlies are somehow good.
Right.
Or quasi-good.
Ja Morant.
I don't know how that happened.
Jaren Jackson Jr. Like, keep it going.
Draft well, kids. Draft well. That's all that it comes down to. But like they'd move off any of the draft picks they have left. They just don't have the salaries to match. So I think they might be in a position similar to Philadelphia where you're not looking for the same player, but when the buyout deadline comes around, and I think you'll see a lot of players bought out. You know, I think it could be a very active buyout stretch where, you know, you go from early February to March.
Andre Iguodala getting bought out? Do you have thoughts on that?
Memphis? I'm a little peeved that peeved is wrong, right? I don't really care that much. But like the fact that, you know, why does bring him back? Like, why do you send guys home? Like, I don't really understand that.
Yeah.
Like, what's the worst that could happen? You'd be better? Like, you kind of are at that point where you want to be better, right?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't Iguodala be a positive influence on Morant and Jackson and all the young guys they have there? They have what Memphis has done, that new front office, has been A-level work.
Right.
What's separated them from being A-plus has been what they've done with Iguodala. I don't really get that. Like, bring him back, let him play. And if you're Iguodala, like, I don't care what you're doing at home right now. Like, you're not in game shape.
Right.
You're just not. So play it out, you know, see if they can find a trade partner. And if you do get bought out after February, 8th or something like that,
yep.
You at least will be in shape and ready to go when the Lakers and the Clippers come banging on your door and have a street fight to see who gets you. Do you disagree? I mean, away, what do you think of him being away from the team?
It always kind of confused me to begin with. And to your point, they've got a lot of young players that you would think it would be beneficial to have him be around and just and maybe that was not what he I don't know whose final decision it was to be with the team, be away from the team. I don't know if it was more what Andre wanted, what the team wanted, what
it seemed
they
like
both
they were on the same page from
thought
moments,
was
yeah. I just don't think they thought they'd be this good. Like I don't
well that's the other factor. And for Iguodala, maybe he himself thought if they didn't think they were going to be that good and he didn't want to be just slugging around and showing up to
because Memphis has a crappy reputation the last like 5-6 years.
Yeah.
Like they've been on a downward trend.
So there's a lot of things that you wouldn't necessarily anticipate.
Memphis in the eighth seed right now. They're tied with San Antonio.
They're
they're sitting in the eighth seed. Like, and if you're looking at the team that might have the best chance of maintaining that spot, Memphis or San Antonio, I know we look at the zombie Spurs and think they're going to find a way into the playoffs, but I think
and also
and
the
Jackson
Spurs may have some decision. Like, do they keep DeRozan around? Like, who knows what exactly their plans are and what they want to do?
Like, if you're Memphis, bring him back. Let him finish out the season. Unless you get a trade offer that includes some kind of protected first-round pick, bring him back. Bring him back into the mix. Let him play it out there. But Boston, to me, is another team. Like, whether it's Tristan Thompson.
Yeah, I cut you off from Boston.
No, but, like, Tristan Thompson, if he gets bought, I think would be an ideal fit with the Celtics. But, again, you'll have to fight with teams for him because I think the Clippers would want another big man in their mix. That, to me, is almost – I think the trade deadline is really interesting because the Covington types and there are a few others that are likely going to get moved. Kevin Love, I think, is likely going to get moved. But I think the buyout – period
is going to be more exciting
could
than
see some pretty active
trade market
active teams there. All right, let's finish. And I talked about this a little bit last week with Jeremy Wu, but you saw Markelle Fultz play. We were both at that game last week when Fultz just went off and had his best game of his career, 25 points, came into a tie game in the fourth quarter and put up 7 straight to knock the Nets off in that one. You got a good look at him. Your thoughts on what you saw?
I'm not going to lie. It was a tough night for the Nets and it was part of their losing streak. It was so fun watching Markelle Fultz. And for an individual, and I know you were around it with Philadelphia, everything you always heard was about what a great teammate he was. And there was a lot of uncertainty and unknown and question marks about his tenure and his time with Philadelphia and trying to figure out what was going on with him health-wise. But you're reminded, and so to that point, I don't feel like I saw him live that much or had a real great taste of that. I also think With that being said, even watching, you know, I saw him some in Washington, but not to the extent of really seeing him. Goodness gracious, like you're reminded of some of the skill set that he brings to the table, the athleticism, how the pace he gets into the offense, and just his ability to, he's got great size. Obviously, the wingspan is what's crazy, but just how he was really able to navigate and manipulate through a defense, and just the things, his court vision, some of the passes he was making. And his shot is slow. Like it's a, you know, the 3-point shots, they were going in. It doesn't look that pretty. But I just, is again, as a NBA fan, was excited to see him taking those shots right out of the gate and not afraid, you know, to put him up. I was looking at his numbers. So he's played in 38 games this season. He started in 33. He is at 67 3-point field goal attempt. He's shooting just over 25%, but taking close to 2 threes a game. So at least he's taking them. And he's so dynamic in getting to the basket that he, even though the shot is a little bit slower and he's not getting it off as quickly, you're so concerned about him getting to the middle of the floor. You're so concerned about him getting to the rim, working his mid-range game, finding teammates, that he has time. I mean, that's what opened him up. And that's, you know, teams will, and I'm sure they will continue to game plan the sense of, yeah, we'll live with that shot. Sure, if he wants to take, you know, eventually regress to the mean and he may make one or two. But then... However, with all of that being said, when he in the fourth quarter, when he just took over and was making such excellent plays and knocking down shots and getting himself to the basket, it just it reminded you the type of player that he was expected to be, the road that's gotten him to this point, and just really happy for him as a player and as an individual and a great fit in Steve Clifford's system and how they play, all the things, just really happy for him.
I didn't realize before I went down there and watched him for a few games, just how physical he was.
Yeah.
And in that Nets game in particular, he would go to the basket and just shrug off Garrett Temple, shrug off Spencer Dinwiddie. These are veteran players
that are
mature.
Yes.
That are much in much better shape. And this is a guy in Fultz who really hasn't been able to do any kind of upper body work at all. I mean, he only started playing basketball again this summer, like midsummer. So I'm just thinking to myself, watching him play like this right now, and if you give him another summer to build up his body, he's basically a rookie. Another summer to build up his body, he's going to get more physical. You get him with the right shooting coach. They've got good shooting coaches down there in Orlando. You keep working on that form, he's going to be a problem. He is going to be a big problem in this league.
To that point, like for his quickness or how he can move in the open court, he knows how to use his body. He gets guys on his hips. So yep. He'll use a pick and roll.
He was excellent at that at Washington.
And he'll get, and that's where it's like, man, you can't do anything because you can't get around him. He knows how to use his body to leverage off where a defender's at and how to get off a shot. And so, yeah, that, like, he's got all these different unique qualities that he has in his game, and it's and just in a setting that, and maybe that's good in, you know, with Orlando and the media market or the attention. I mean, I don't feel maybe that's helped, just that there hasn't been quite as much scrutiny. You think
I don't think he could have done this in Philadelphia.
What he went through in Philadelphia, like a practice by practice and the social media, look at a shot here, so it's just, again, it goes back to, I'm just really happy for him to find such a great fit and a great place to be at. And certainly doesn't need to, with the other players they have on the roster, doesn't need to be the go-to guy, but has an opportunity to be. It's great stuff.
You know,
great stuff.
Watching him too, one thing I don't believe he could have done this in Philadelphia because the situations are different. The expectations would have been different. He's the number one pick. It just would have been a lot for him to deal with mentally as he's trying to get back physically. But it does strike me that sometimes teams, they don't, like, there's no such thing anymore as a career-ending injury. Like, there's isn't. Like, for young guys. Like, if a guy's, like, between the ages of, like, 18 and 25, he suffers a major injury, it's not career-ending. They don't really exist. Like,
right.
The foot's kind of scary at this point, but ACL tears, guys get over. And I'm watching Fultz, and I'm thinking of, like, where would Minnesota be if they just drafted Joel Embiid and not Andrew Wiggins and just waited a couple of years? You know, I'm watching, you know, Michael Porter a couple of weeks back go off and have a big game for the Nuggets. He was drafted 14th overall. Like, the guy drafted before him, Jerome Robinson, who, let's go Eagles, former Boston College player, but
right.
Not panning out at this point. Like, why? Like,
Well, and that's
the problem with Porter. He had to wait. Like, he had to wait and hope, like, his injury healed. Injuries, guys get over injuries. They just do. Like, it's, you got many, like, how many people are on the Nets staff these days? Like, there's, like, there's three pages in the staffers.
I mean, look, and Fultz is 21, yes. 21 years old. And sometimes, to that point, and with injuries, and not to say, I mean, I guess you can look at that Ben Simmons related, but not really. But sometimes, like, yeah, maybe it'll take a year, it'll take some time, but that also gives a guy time to acclimate themselves to the league, to being a professional, to the course of travel, to the different things you need to do. Like, sometimes there's not as much of a drawback as you would think of things to, and it's a long NBA season. So even two with players, if they're missing 20 games, if they're missing 30 games, is it ideal? No. However, a lot can change and a lot can happen. Yeah, it's in just how, yeah, but that's why I think it's such a extraordinarily hard job to think about the jobs of these organizations, the front offices, drafting, looking at player. Like, you're trying to figure out what a 17, 18, 19 year old kid is going to become, with many of them who've played 1 year of college, or 2 years of college. And it's there's a lot of unknowns and a lot of X factors that go along with that.
The one, and Jeremy and I had this argument last week, but because he pointed out, like, the one potential issue is, you know, because he's playing well now, do you overpay him down the line and the injury resurfaces and he doesn't kind of live up to the expectation? That's a fair question, but you have like a year and a half to look at. You have basically two full seasons to figure out if he's past the injury, what kind of player he's going to be before you have to pay him at like the tender age of 22 to get a long-term deal. Now, and then it's a restricted free agent situation, so you're protected in that area. So I think the Magic, you're going to be popping champagne corks.
Yeah.
Have a star, a potential star point guard on your team to go along with, you know, they like Jonathan Isaac a lot down there. Vucevic is a terrific player.
Yeah, it was a tough loss for them.
Yeah. I don't know how long Aaron Gordon is. I don't know if Aaron Gordon's long. He might be redundant with Isaac. I think they like him better in that mix. But you got a nice little foundation. You got the one position that is indispensable. Point guard is indispensable in this league, and you now have it manned maybe for the next 10 years. And a coach, like I've had this conversation with Kemba Walker. Others have too. Steve Clifford did a lot for Kemba Walker in Charlotte. Like, Kemba will be the first one to stay. Steve Clifford got me to that next level. Now you have the same coach here working with you in Orlando. That's a big win-win for Markelle Fultz.
I'm a huge fan of Steve Clifford. Yeah. Huge fan of him and just how he has his teams playing.
He's a good Vermonter, too. So we share that bond as people that have houses in Vermont.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes,
you
good
and
Vermonter.
You and your houses all over the country.
All over the Northeast. Just the Northeast.
Three, four, five
Steve
houses.
Steve Clifford and I are going to go into the bar business together when he's done. He's going to run a bar, and I'm going to be part owner of the bar.
Is this really a part of a plan?
Not really. Well, maybe like 20
Why don't I ever get involved in any of these things?
Well, this is a Vermont bar. You're more of the New Yorker type.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to go. Well... I'm not saying that's good or bad, but yeah, I probably am not going to make my way to Vermont.
Sarah, always appreciate it. Thanks for coming to studio.
Manix, thank you for having me. And it was a pleasure to be in studio with you.
And if we're not in studio next time, but we sound like it, maybe we will be.
But we probably won't tell you.
Thank you.